Content warning, today's episode of So Many Books, So Little Time, Catch-22, Chapter 3, contains obvious war themes and language that is surrounding sanity, as well as a scenario in a brothel which may be implying underage interactions that are not appropriate. Also violence, obviously.
Hey, folks, Dave here.
Andrew.
And welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
Today we will be continuing with Catch-22 by Joseph Heller with Chapter 3. Join us, won't you? Hey, Rue, how are you going?
Hectic, busy, crazy.
Hectic, busy, not busy. Crazy.
Well, look, technically diagnosed, so yes, no, but I can use that word. It's fine.
I've heard, we had a big discussion about it yesterday. We were going to record yesterday, but they were mowing the park. Damn, council mowers. But we had a good discussion. Yes. Rue, you finished book 16 and 17 of the Dresden Files this week.
Yes.
Sitting or over a day, or how was it?
Yeah, over a day. With interruptions, but I pretty much did it in that day.
That was me when the books came out. I took the Tuesday off, and I went to the cafe, I got some food, I came back. I did a bit of work each day, but it was mostly like, yay, now I'm just going to lay down on my bed and read another hour or two. And before I knew it, that was also where I was up to like 1 or 2 in the morning finishing them off, which I did the other night, because I finished a book this week. I finally read Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None.
Hmm. Very nice. Much better title.
Those who know the history of that book, we won't go into it here. But yeah, I can definitely see how it influenced pretty much the entire mystery genre afterwards. It really is one of those seminal works. And to be honest, at the end of it, I was like, it was okay. It wasn't great, but maybe just because its influence has been felt in so many other mysteries I've partaken of throughout my lifetime. Like, you know, when you go back to like the originator of something, if you've been familiar with everything that work has birthed, the original might seem a little flat.
Well, yes, possibly. But at the time it would have been innovative. Mm. But yes.
It's still really well put together. It's not quite like a clockwork mechanism, but it's funny. There's an author's note at the start of the book where she talked about how she was really proud of the work she did making everything work out. And regardless of what anyone else thought, it was like she was very proud of accomplishing the task she set for herself. And yeah, mm-hmm. It's one of those where when I was reading the epilogue where it kind of explains how everything happened, it's kind of like, yeah, okay, I can see this. A little ridiculous, but no, it's pretty cool. It's also got a great premise in that there's a house on an island, and 10 visitors arrive at the behest of the owner of the land. Mm. And then things start happening. I'm not going to go any further why they're there.
And then there were none. There you go. That's
well, that is in reference to a poem that is in each of their rooms.
Yes.
And 10 little soldiers in this version of the book.
Yes. And then there were none. And speaking of soldiers.
Yes.
We have Catch-22. I've been watching. So one thing I've been doing whilst I'm trying to do my uni stuff, which is been interesting, is I have MASH playing in the background. Like, it's my background sound. Although the canned laughter starts getting a little old.
Was it canned or was it studio audience?
I don't think it was a studio audience.
Right.
Not sure if it was a studio audience or not. I doubt it. But, yeah, we've been... so that's been happening in the background. And sometimes I switch it over to the German dubbing just because there is no canned laughter.
Ah.
But I can't hear German whilst doing whilst writing in English, so that's the problem.
I understand that.
I start writing German, and that's not what I'm meant to be doing.
Mm.
Although, arguably, I'm not writing in English either, because it's academic scientific language, so not really English.
It really is its own language.
It is. Although I'm trying to make it so it's decipherable and clear and not confusing. Anyway, if I think about it too much, it's going to just...
We'll also spiral off in a 30-minute discussion about your dissertation. And as a friend, I appreciate what you're doing. I don't have the knowledge to follow along, and I'm sure our readers would not appreciate it as...
No. It's frustrating because science. Science, good. Oversight, good. Accountability, transparency, good. But there's some issues with some of the things that we do and why we do them in the sense of how we write. Could be better. It could be smoother. Yeah. Could be more efficient and more accessible. But hey, that's something to work towards. There we go. Well, there's room for improvement.
Maybe you should be writing in German because, you know, one of the jokes about the German people is they are very efficient.
Well, they're good at finding one word that is the length of the paragraph to replace the entire, page worth of discussion.
Which is segmented language is pretty cool.
It is very fun. It is great. Yes. Sorry, just having reminders of some of the words that you kind of, that just start forming. There's a whole bunch of words. Thanks to the global pandemic, there have been a whole bunch of words that were invented in German.
Ah, the one that always comes to mind when I think of segmented is how a lot of kanji, Japanese and Chinese, and I
actually, yes,
were are usually combinations of previous words.
I wouldn't be surprised if Japanese and kanji Japanese and Chinese and a couple of the other segmented languages have not come up with new words as well.
But the one I always see floating around on like Reddit and meme sites and that is the kanji for penguin is made up of the kanji for business and the kanji for goose. So a penguin is a business goose.
Still my favorite.
Mm.
It should be a cool business goose, but that's just my feelings on that. Chili business goose. Icy business goose? No. It's like Antarctica and the Arctic, that one is Arctic with bear, Antarctic without bear.
So it's bear of bears.
Bear versus no bear. Circle of bears, circle of no bears.
Bear bears.
Bears on bears.
Oh, so you made a segue maybe about 5 minutes ago into Catch-22.
Yes, so returning to that segue of soldiers.
Soldiers.
Army and
yes, war. Army men. Now, are the characters of MASH as unhinged as the crew we've seen so far in Catch-22?
Yes. That's yes. They're a different kind of unhinged. I think probably because it's set in a... hospital setting, the unhingedness is it's the combination of people who in theory a physician wants to be a source of healing and well-being. And they're also a lot of them are civilians, they're not career army. So they're draftees, they're civilian doctors that got drafted. So a lot of them are like that. Some are and some aren't. It's interesting where you see the clash in cultures, the clash in what is accepted and appropriate and just taken on the chin within the military. And a lot of it also, they discuss a lot of the nonsensical things like if you fill in a requisition form for, there was one episode at some such, and okay, guys, it's not a spoiler by now. The series has been it was old when I grew up. So the idea of they had a requisition, they needed, I think they needed warm blankets and they got sent summer shirts or summer gum boots or something. Or they got sent, or they needed penicillin. They got sent something completely unhelpful and like, I know one of them was like a giant stack of toilet paper, or like they got sent very strange things. And it was because if if the papers aren't paperwork isn't filled in triplicate in a certain way and whatever, and then the army also not having a good logistical thing in the middle of a war because there's combat and the delays of things. So it was it's interesting because it does look at that, and it does also the frustration, like and I'll just give a warning for anyone who's seen combat, that this is describing something that happens, which is this idea of friendly fire and the absurdity of it, and this idea of that, you know, the hospital area was getting shelled at some stage, and it was being shelled by their own people. Like, and the way that it was responded was when they call them, they go, "Hey guys, there's shelling going on. Our hospital's being shelled," and they're going, and the response is, some dude somewhere completely remote from this situation is like, "That, according to my intelligence reports, you should not be experiencing any shelling," kind of thing. Da, 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 da. And the guy's like, "You can hear it in the background of my phone call. Like, it's the room is shaking," kind of thing. And then he calls back later, and the guy goes, "Oh yeah, well, yes, I can now confirm intelligence has said that you are actually experiencing shelling, but good news, it's not the enemy, it's us." and I can't deliver it the way that that whole scene did, but there's some brilliant, I mean, some of it has not aged well. I tell you this if you are thinking of getting into MASH, which is, by the way, on Disney now, so you can watch it, because on Disney Star, I guess, if you have that. There are issues. There's a lot of issues. There's the racism. There's the sanism. There's the fat shaming. There's all that kind of, like, things that were done in the name of humor, but also in the name of, like, that now we recognize it. Probably then also recognize it's not actually healthy, but we were less aware of that it was not steeped in a great thing. It's of the time. It doesn't make it any, like, the harm any better, but it does mean that you look at it from a lens of, okay, I get it. That's okay. That didn't age well.
Well,
that's why we say it didn't age well.
It's only, what, like a decade removed from when Catch-22 was published. And so far, some of the language and attitudes in Catch-22 have been very of the time. And I'm making air quotes, because same thing when we read Brave New World, and less so with Anna Green Gables and Northanger Abbey. But we talked about it before when you interact with something that was made in a different era, you kind of have to make allowances, not excuses. You make allowances for the attitudes of that era. And part of, I think, being a good critic is you always have to look at something from a modern lens while also placing yourself when it was written. Yeah. If just to understand, you know, sometimes the character motivation, sometimes the elements of the plot, you kind of need to have that context to really know what's going on.
Yeah. And I think also just being able to go, okay, I'm going to, the people who were composing this or writing this, although they might be crafting a great story and thing, I'm able to pause and go, okay, there's language in here that reflects a certain attitude, and they feel that they are permitted or they're entitled to using that kind of language. And we have this with Catch-22, where you've had to edit certain words out. And you and I can sit here and go, well, at the time, this guy who's writing it, Heller would have considered, oh, he's trying to show how that other person is actually racist, or that other person is actually full of bias and bigotry. But it's convenient often for an author to do it that way, by using the language itself that depicts that, whilst deflecting from examining that attitude within their own self. Like, It is something that is still done, and often some that's where you've got, you know, the people who say who try and get permission to say certain words that they really know they should not be using because they have an extremely harmful meaning and history, and say, oh, but I'm friends with no, but my friend says it's okay. Even if your friend says it's okay, just don't. Certain words, it's better off, like, think about it. Why do you want to say it?
Yeah, that's often a very uncomfortable question.
Yeah, people are saying, oh, but people are so fussy. It's just a joke. Da-da-da-da. Like, that's where we start saying when we're not willing to actually reflect and think, where do these terms come from? What do they mean? And then, and instead of examining why do I want to say it, you go, but what? Why is it okay for them to say it?
But also, I think examining why you want to say it is the right way, because then from the other side, I think there is also danger when you make a word taboo, you give it more power.
Yes. And I think, and the question is, if your motivation to say it is to disempower it, it's still not your place to do it. Because if you are a person to whom that label is not, against that label is not being used.
Let's put something on this. Usually these words are a slur against a group of people.
Yes. So these words that we're referring to particularly slur words. There's some words that have fallen out of favor because they're not, they've been used as a slur, but they're not a slur. So not technically, but they've become slurs by the way that they're used. It sounds strange, but I'm not talking to the obvious words.
Or even the opposite, where, you know, sometimes words change their meaning over time as well. So when you're reading an older book, you have to account for that. Oh, that word means something completely different for me. But usually, especially as a reader, you learn quite quickly what those words are. So when you encounter them, you are prepared for them.
Well, I've had to explain the word gaily to my brother. Gay.
That was one that came to
Anne of Green Gables. Yes. I'm so gay. And you're going, okay, so in nowadays in our modern context, that has a meaning that is not the same as the meaning in which it was in the book. And that's fine. You just have to know that. And I mean, it's not a slur, but it has been used as one, and it does get used as one depending on the setting.
Well, these days, especially, we're far removed from when I was at high school, but when I was in high school, gay was also kind of synonymous with bad. If you didn't like something, you'd say that was gay.
And that was still, and it's, I mean, it still happens to some extent. It depends on who's saying it, why they're saying it, and how they're saying it. And I mean, the same holds true of every word, with exception of very obvious slurs. Yes. Like, obvious.
The ones we have been editing out. If you are following along reading, you know what those words are when you find them in the text.
There are certain words that are just like, no, and then if you are of the population, that is for that person to decide as to whether they will or will not have that word as part of their vocabulary. It's the same way that I kind of refer to myself sometimes as being a bit of a, like, I jokingly will say something about being a cripple. That's because I literally have physical disabilities. And because it's something that I will get called or have been called as, maybe jokingly, but it has been, it's slur language.
It's kind of like where I have, you know, well, actually, I have diagnosed difficulties, but also likely undiagnosed difficulties. So I've always been very uncomfortable with the R word.
Yes, but that's also a word that there's no way of, there's with exception of flame.
Or the idea to, it has that meaning to kind of, to stop something, to pull back.
Yes, and even then, there are other words that are an option.
Yeah.
And this is not about controlling language, because we know that language shifts and, we all know that language shifts and changes over time. Mm-hmm. The exception of French because of the cavité française.
You know, we've made that joke many times on the podcast, but it never ceases to be funny.
No, it's always going to be funny. Anyway, so we've got that going on. So we know language shifts and changes, and what we now consider acceptable will not be acceptable in how many years' time. Attitudes we have now will not be acceptable in the future. We can't control these kind of things. We can work towards something that is embracing. The same way we can't, we will be judged by the future. We can evaluate and assess the past and determine
here's something
context
as well that just kind of hit me, and maybe it does apply more as a person who reads, but you know, these words that we're making taboo or we choose not to say. It seems so odd that there's such a backlash to the idea of removing them from language. Just the fact that we're speaking English. You know, I mean, how many words does this language have that keep getting added? We have synonyms for everything.
Yeah.
It is not difficult to find a substitute for a word.
Not only that, it's not... People keep complaining that it's about limiting language. It isn't. It's about adjusting and refining language and expanding our vocabulary to actually be more suitable, more broad, more capable of describing a situation.
Yes, because not to stereotype, but I think we've all run into people who tend to use the F word every second or third word because they don't seem to have much more of a vocabulary, and how kind of off-putting that is.
And at the same time, like, I'm not going to judge someone for having a limited vocabulary. Mm. However, I would like to encourage everyone to expand their vocabulary. Mm-hmm. And it's not just because, oh, you want to sound fancy. No. We're talking about, why shouldn't you work on being able to express yourself
again,
better?
Again, we're readers. Language is beautiful. A finely crafted sentence, it sings. It's glorious.
And none of us is ever going to know the meaning of every single word.
No.
If you feel uncomfortable because you don't know a word and you have to look it up, you know what you're doing when you're looking it up. You are learning something new. And that's good. That's your brain expanding.
One of my favorite things about the Kindle is anytime I don't know a word when I'm reading, which is often, I go and I highlight it and the dictionary in the Kindle tells me what it is. And if the word is odd, if it's not in that dictionary, then I Google the word and then I find out. We've had to do that. We usually don't leave them in the episode, but sometimes we've had to go on like a Google search for what something means and take like a 5-minute detour because it's just such a odd either turn of phrase or word that we've never come across and it's not in the dictionary. But and those are often fun because it is a sense of discovery. Mm. And I have debated with myself whether or not to leave those in when I'm editing.
Sometimes, the thing is, that's the thing we do. And I think, dear listeners, if you do that, all the power to you. It means that you're taking charge of your own learning. It's you're taking charge of your own expansion and ability to express and understand and communicate beyond the limitations that someone else may or may not impose on you. Mm. It's about constantly expanding. And I think that's what's beautiful about language is that it's not something that needs to be limited. It is right now limited by access, by education, by all these things. But we are increasingly able to expand that. We're increasingly able to access more.
Yeah, no, it's never been easier to access a book, a movie, an album, a game that you want to experience. You might need a little bit of extracurricular know-how, but even the ability to search these things out, you can find out how to find out.
And there's whole disciplines now dedicated. Okay, we were talking about the science thing before and didn't bring it up. Yeah, I'm not going to bring it up. Don't worry. Mm-hmm. Don't be scared. But
we're already far past when we should have started reading, but yes, continue.
But yes, the idea is that that's why we now have entire disciplines like science communication or other things that it's still very much in its infancy. So they're still getting their heads wrapped around it. But the idea of how do you make certain things more and more accessible in a way that's accurate and clear, and a person can feel encouraged to build up on concepts that they may not have known before, or they just take what they need from it, and that's enough.
The ability to break down an advanced concept so you can explain it to someone who does not have the education to understand it the way it is usually communicated, that's a skill in itself. The ability to, there's a Reddit called Explain Like I'm Five, and it sounds a little flippant, but I do think there's a truth in that. If you can break down an advanced concept so you could explain it to a 5-year-old, I mean, that's a skill in itself. And
in
I don't
theory,
think
that's what a PhD student's meant to be able to do, but it's not
easy. But we get trapped within the language of our disciplines.
Yes, jargonism and things like that. And I think when we're reading, as we're reading Catch-22, there is a lot of there is actually quite a bit of jargonism coming up. It's little bits that are very, very military specific kind of language, which is what you would expect from someone who's most likely been through military. I think Keller was writing influenced by experience at this point.
Maybe either the final episode of our Catch-22 read or, you know, in between episodes should look up whether he actually served.
That would be interesting. Or at least he was in proximity with people who have served, because he's you can't write this without
having a lot of because I think a lot of the authors of the 60s were World War II veterans.
If they weren't World War II veterans, they would have been Korean Korean War, which, by the way, is what MASH is set in, and that's why it's interesting to me.
So I think we need to start reading, but let's do a quick recap. In the not much actually happened in the last chapter. We learned a little how Yessarian winds up what was his name, Clevenger,
he's not well. Yessarian is not well. He is...
No one's well. There's a man shooting at mice with a 45 caliber revolver. Fair.
Yes, there is a certain amount of big surprise being in a situation where you are constantly fraught with death and people are trying to kill you, and you are involved in the killing of innocent people potentially as well, and that you have no control over this thing, is leading to some mental distress.
Let me quote something from the last chapter, which I think actually sums it up perfectly. It was one of the Clevenger Yessarian back and forths where Yessarian was like, "They're trying to kill me. No one's trying to kill you." "Yes, they are. They're shooting at me. They're shooting at everyone." And Yessarian's like, "Exactly."
Yeah. They're being shot at, they can't escape, there's no way of getting out of there, and they have no choice, and their deaths are considered to be, you know, just, it's a necessary expense.
And Yessarian needs 50 missions to leave, he's done 46, so, I mean, that's pretty impressive, the idea of accomplishing or surviving 46, I'm assuming, plane or bombing missions.
Yeah, and I think, and whilst having things shot at him and other things, so yes.
Because when I was a teenager, I was given Boy and Going Solo, Roald Dahl's autobiographies, and I read them a couple times. He was a fighter pilot in World War II, and he wrote about many of the skirmishes he was part of, and just how quickly his friends would be torn out of the sky, just routinely.
I think, there's a lot of, regarding the futility of war, I think this second chapter?
Yeah, it was the second.
Sorry. The second chapter really kind of gives you, it's at a glance, it gives you what is being sensed. This futility is already sensed as a theme.
Yeah. Well, with that lovely sentiment, why don't we lead into chapter 3? Chapter 3, Havermeyer. Actually, no one was around when Yessarian returned from the hospital, but Orr and the dead man in Yessarian's tent. The dead man in Yessarian's tent was a pest, and Yessarian didn't like him, even though he had never seen him. Having him lying around all day annoyed Yessarian so much that he had gone to the orderly room several times to complain to Sergeant Towser, who refused to admit that the dead man even existed, which, of course, he no longer did. It was still more frustrating to try to appeal directly to Major Major, the long and bony squadron commander, who looked a little bit like Henry Fonda in distress, and went jumping out the window of his office each time Yessarian bullied his way past Sergeant Towser to speak to him about it. The dead man in Yessarian's tent was simply not easy to live with. He even disturbed Orr, who was not easy to live with either, and who, on the day Yessarian came back, was tinkering with the faucet that fed gasoline into the stove he had started building while Yessarian was in the hospital. "What are you doing?" Yessarian asked guardedly when he entered the tent, although he saw it once. "There's a leak here," Orr said. "I'm trying to fix it." "Please stop it," said Yessarian. "You're making me nervous." "When I was a kid," Orr replied, "I used to walk around all day with crab apples in my cheeks, one in each cheek." Yessarian put aside the musset bag from which he had begun removing his toilet articles and braced himself suspiciously. A minute passed. "Why?" he found himself forced to ask finally, or tittered triumphantly, "Because they're better than horse chestnuts," he answered. Or was kneeling on the floor of the tent. He worked without pause, taking the faucet apart, spreading all the tiny pieces out carefully, counting and then studying each one interminably, as though he had never seen anything remotely similar before, and then reassembling the whole apparatus over and over and over and over again, with no loss of patience or interest, no sign of fatigue, no indication of ever concluding. Yessarion watched him tinkering and felt certain he would be compelled to murder him in cold blood if he did not stop. His eyes moved toward the hunting knife that had been slung over the mosquito net bar by the dead man the day he arrived. The knife hung beside the dead man's empty leather gun holster, from which Havermeyer had stolen the gun. "When I couldn't get crab apples," Orr continued, "I used horse chestnuts. Horse chestnuts are about the same size as crab apples and actually have a better shape, although the shape doesn't matter a bit." "Why did you walk around with crab apples in your cheeks?" Yessarion asked again. "That's what I asked." "Because they've got a better shape than horse chestnuts," Orr answered. "I just told you that." "Why," swore Yessarion at him approvingly, "you evil-eyed, mechanically aptituded, disaffiliated son of a bitch, did you walk around with anything in your cheeks?" "I didn't," Orr said, "walk around with anything in my cheeks. I walked around with crab apples in my cheeks. When I couldn't get crab apples, I walked around with horse chestnuts in my cheeks." Orr giggled. Yessarion made up his mind to keep his mouth shut and did. Orr waited. Yessarion waited longer. "One in each cheek," Orr said. "Why?" Orr pounced. "Why what?" Yessarion shook his head, smiling, and refused to say. "It's a funny thing about this valve," Orr mused aloud. "What is?" Yessarion asked. "Because I want it," Yessarion knew. "Jesus Christ, what did you want?" "Apple cheeks." "Apple cheeks?" Yessarion demanded. "I wanted apple cheeks," Orr repeated. "Even when I was a kid, I wanted apple cheeks someday, and I decided to work at it until I got them. And by God, I did work at it until I got them. And that's how I did it, with crab apples in my cheeks all day long." He giggled again, "one in each cheek." "Why did you want apple cheeks?" "I didn't want apple cheeks," Orr said. "I wanted big cheeks. I didn't care about the color so much, but I wanted them big. I worked at it just like one of those crazy guys you read about who go around squeezing rubber balls all day long just to strengthen their hands. In fact, I was one of those crazy guys. I used to walk around all day with rubber balls in my hands too." "Why? Why what? Why?" "Why did you walk around all day with rubber balls in your hands?" "Because rubber balls," said Orr, "are better than crab apples." Orr sniggered as he shook his head. "I did it to protect my good reputation in case anyone ever caught me walking around with crab apples in my cheeks. With rubber balls in my hands, I could deny there were crab apples in my cheeks. Every time someone asked me why I was walking around with crab apples in my cheeks, I just opened my hands and showed them it was rubber balls I was walking around with, not crab apples, and that they were in my hands, not my cheeks. It was a good story, but I never knew if it got across or not. Since it's pretty tough to make people understand you when you're talking to them with two crab apples in your cheeks." Yessarion found it pretty tough to understand him then, and he wondered once again if Orr wasn't talking to him with the tip of his tongue in one of his apple cheeks. Yessarion decided not to utter another word. It would be futile. He knew Orr, and he knew there was not a chance in hell of finding out from him then why he had wanted big cheeks. It would do no more good to ask than it had done to ask him why that had kept beating him over the head with her shoe that morning in Rome in the cramped vestibule outside the open door of Natalie's kid sister's room.
Oh no.
Hmm?
Oh no.
She was a tall, strapping girl with long hair and incandescent blue veins, converging populously beneath her cocoa-colored skin where the flesh was most tender. And she kept cursing and shrieking and jumping high up into the air on her bare feet to keep right on hitting him on the top of his head with the spiked heel of her shoe. They were both naked and raising a rumpus that brought everyone in the apartment into the hall to watch. Each couple in a bedroom doorway, all of them naked except the aproned and sweatered old woman who clucked reprovingly and the lecherous, dissipated old man who cackled aloud hilariously through the whole episode with a kind of avid and superior glee. The girl shrieked and Orr giggled. Each time she landed with the heel of her shoe, Orr giggled louder, infuriating her still further so that she flew up still higher into the air for another shot at his noodle, her wondrously full breasts soaring all over the place like billowing pennants in a strong wind, and her buttocks and strong thighs shimmying this way and that way like some horrifying bonanza. She shrieked and or giggled right up to the time she shrieked and knocked him cold with a good solid crack on the temple that made him stop giggling and sent him off to the hospital in a stretcher with a hole in his head that wasn't very deep and a very mild concussion that kept him out of combat only 12 days. Nobody could find out what had happened, not even the cackling old man and clucking old woman, who were in a position to find out everything that happened in that vast and endless brothel, with its multitudinous bedrooms on facing sides of the narrow hallways going off in opposite directions from the spacious sitting room with its shaded windows and single lamp. Every time she met or after that, she'd hoist her skirts up over her tight, white, elastic panties and, jeering coarsely, bulge her firm, round belly out at him, cursing him contemptuously and then roaring with husky laughter as she saw him giggle fearfully and take refuge behind Yessarian. Whatever he had done or tried to do or failed to do behind the closed door of Nately's kid sister's room was still a secret. The girl wouldn't tell Nately's or any of the other or Nately or Yessarian, or might tell, but Yessarian had decided not to utter another word.
Sorry, just going back.
Mm-hmm.
I did it to protect my good reputation. Then Yessarian going off into this mental dialogue of interacting him obviously as some sort of misbehavior. So much so that he was getting beaten up in a brothel.
Mm.
And
you know what I like most about what we just read is that as mad as Yessarian makes like Clevenger and obviously some of his officers, you know, like the major jumps out the window rather than talk to him, it seems Orr has that effect on Yessarian.
Yes. There's something though with regarding that. Why he kept beating him over the head with her shoe in the morning, just context. In the cramped vestibule outside the open door of Nately's Bleep's kid sister's room.
So it's a kid sister of the woman.
Yes. So if you think about it,
he was making passes towards an underage girl, perhaps.
Passes?
I'm trying to be polite.
I think he's
going further.
Yeah, I think he's actually completely messed up.
Mm.
I mean, they all are, but yeah, no, yep. So,
Well, we'll keep that in mind. But I think we might be able. I think we might be about to find out about the crab apples in the cheeks.
Of course.
Do you want to know why I wanted big cheeks? Orr asked. Yessarian kept his mouth shut. Do you remember, Orr said, that time in Rome when that girl who can't stand you kept hitting me over the head with the heel of her shoe? Do you want to know why she was hitting me? It was still impossible to imagine what he could have done to make her angry enough to hammer him over the head for 15 or 20 minutes, yet not angry enough to pick him up by the ankles and dash his brains out. She was certainly tall enough, and Orr was certainly short enough. Orr had buck teeth and bulging eyes to go with his big cheeks, and was even smaller than Yen Hupple, who lived on the wrong side of the railroad tracks in the tent in the administration area in which Hungry Joe lay screaming in his sleep every night. The administration area in which Hungry Joe had pitched his tent by mistake lay in the center of the squadron between the ditch with its rusted railroad tracks and the tilted black bituminous road. The men could pick up girls along that road if they promised to take them where they wanted to go. Buxom, young, homely, grinning girls with missing teeth whom they could drive off the road and lie down in the wild grass with, and Yessarian did whenever he could, which was not nearly as often as Hungry Joe, who could get a jeep but couldn't drive, begged him to try. The tents of the enlisted men in the squadron stood on the other side of the road, alongside the open-air movie theater, in which, for the daily amusement of the dying, ignorant armies clashed by night on a collapsible screen, and to which another USO troop came that same afternoon. The USO troops were sent by General P.P. Peckham, who had moved his headquarters up to Rome and had nothing better to do while he schemed against General Dreidel. General Peckham was a general with whom neatness definitely counted. He was a spry, suave, and very precise general who knew the circumference of the equator and always wrote enhanced when he meant increased. He was a prick, and no one knew this better than General Dreidel, who was incensed by General Peckham's recent directive requiring all tents in the Mediterranean Theater of Operations to be pitched along parallel lines with entrances facing back proudly toward the Washington Monument.
What?
To General Dreidel, who ran a fighting outfit, it seemed a lot of crap. Furthermore, it was none of General Peckham's goddamn business how the tents in General Dreidel's wing were pitched. There then followed a hectic jurisdictional dispute between these overlords that was decided in General Dreidel's favor by ex-PFC Wintergreen, mail clerk at 27th Air Force Headquarters. Wintergreen determined the outcome by throwing all communications from General Peckham into the wastebasket. He found them too prolix. General Dreidel's views, expressed in less pretentious literary style, pleased ex-PFC Wintergreen and were sped along by him in zealous observance of regulations. General Dreidel was victorious by default. To regain whatever status he had lost, General Peckham began sending out more USO troops than he had ever sent out before and assigned to Colonel Cargill himself the responsibility of generating enough enthusiasm for them. But there was no enthusiasm in Yossarian's group. In Yossarian's group, there was only a mounting number of enlisted men and officers who found their way solemnly to Sergeant Towser several times a day to ask if the orders sending them home had come in. They were men who had finished their 50 missions. There were more of them now than when Yossarian had gone into the hospital, and they were still waiting. They worried and bit their nails. They were grotesque, like useless young men in a depression. They moved sideways like crabs. They were waiting for the order sending them home to safety to return from 27th Air Force Headquarters in Italy. And while they waited, they had nothing to do but worry and bite their nails and find their way solemnly to Sergeant Towser several times a day to ask if the order sending them home to safety had come. They were in a race and knew it, because they knew from bitter experience that Colonel Cathcart might raise the number of missions again at any time. They had nothing better to do than wait. Only Hungry Joe had something better to do each time he finished his missions. He had screaming nightmares and won fistfights with Hupple's cat. He took his camera to the front row of every USO show and tried to shoot pictures up the skirt of the yellow-headed singer with two big ones in a sequin dress that always seemed ready to burst. The pictures never came out. Colonel Cargill, General Peckham's troubleshooter, was a forceful, ruddy man. Before the war, he had been an alert, hard-hitting, aggressive marketing executive. He was a very bad marketing executive. Colonel Cargill was so awful a marketing executive that his services were much sought after by firms eager to establish losses for tax purposes. Throughout the civilized world, from Battery Park to Fulton Street, he was known as a dependable man for a fast tax write-off. His prices were high, for failure often did not come easily. He had to start at the top and work his way down, and with sympathetic friends in Washington, losing money was no simple matter. It took months of hard work and careful misplanning. A person misplaced, disorganized, miscalculated, overlooked everything and opened every loophole. And just when he thought he had it made, the government gave him a lake or a forest or an oil field and spoiled everything. Even with such handicaps, Colonel Cargill could be relied on to run the most prosperous enterprise into the ground. He was a self-made man who owed his lack of success to nobody. Men, Colonel Cargill began in the Yossarian squadron, measuring his pauses carefully, "You're American officers. The officers of no other army in the world can make that statement. Think about it." Oh, that one hit me. Sergeant Knight thought about it and then politely informed Colonel Cargill that he was addressing the enlisted men and that the officers were to be found waiting for him on the other side of the squadron. Colonel Cargill thanked him crisply and glowed with self-satisfaction as he strode across the area. It made him proud to observe that 29 months in the service had not blunted his genius for ineptitude. "Men," he began his address to the officers, measuring his pauses carefully, "you're American officers. The officers of no other army in the world can make that statement. Think about it." He waited a moment to permit them to think about it. "These people are your guests," he shouted suddenly. "They've traveled over 3,000 miles to entertain you. How are they going to feel if nobody wants to go out and watch them? What's going to happen to their morale? Now, men, it's no skin off my behind, but that girl that wants to play the accordion for you today is old enough to be a mother. How would you feel if your own mother traveled over 3,000 miles to play the accordion for some troops that didn't want to watch her? How is that kid whose mother that accordion player is old enough to be going to feel when he grows up and learns about it? We all know the answer to that one. Now, men, don't misunderstand me. This is all voluntary, of course. I'd be the last colonel in the world to order you to go to that USO show and have a good time. But I want every one of you who isn't sick enough to be in a hospital to go to that USO show right now and have a good time. And that's an order."
That's...
I think I like Colonel Cargill.
He's just weird.
He's like the boss in Dilbert.
Pretty much.
Yossarian did feel almost sick enough to go back into the hospital, and he felt even sicker 3 combat missions later when Dr. Nika still shook his melancholy head and refused to ground him. "You think you've got troubles?" Dr. Nika rebuked him grievingly. "What about me? I lived on peanuts for 8 years while I learned how to be a doctor. After the peanuts, I lived on chicken feed in my own office until I could build up a practice decent enough to even pay expenses. Then, just as the shop was finally starting to show a profit, they drafted me. I don't know what you're complaining about." Dr. Nika was Yossarian's friend and would do just about nothing in his power to help him. Yossarian listened very carefully as Dr. Nika told him about Colonel Cathcart at Group, who wanted to be a general, about General Dreidel at Wing and General Dreidel's nurse, and about all the other generals at 27th Air Force Headquarters, who insisted on only 40 missions as a completed tour of duty. "Why don't you just smile and make the best of it?" he advised Yossarian glumly. "Be like Havermeyer." Yossarian shuddered at the suggestion. Havermeyer was a lead bombardier who never took evasive action going into the target, and thereby increased the danger of all the men who flew in the same formation with him.
Wow.
"Havermeyer, why the hell don't you ever take evasive action?" they would demand in a rage after the mission. "Hey, you men leave Captain Havermeyer alone," Colonel Cathcart would order. "He's the best damn bombardier we've got." Havermeyer grinned and nodded and tried to explain how he dum-dummed the bullets with a hunting knife before he fired them at the field mice in his tent every night. Ah, Havermeyer's the mouse killer. That makes sense now that we know he's a reckless bombardier. Havermeyer was the best damn bombardier they had, but he flew straight and level all the way from the IP to the target, and even far beyond the target, until he saw the falling bomb strike ground and explode in a darting spurt of abrupt orange that flashed beneath the swirling pall of smoke and pulverized debris, geysering up wildly in huge rolling waves of gray and black. Havermeyer held mortal men rigid in 6 planes as steady and still as sitting ducks while he followed the bombs all the way down through the plexiglass nose with deep interest and gave the German gunners below all the time they needed to set their sights and take their aim and pull the triggers or lanyards or switches or whatever the hell they did pull when they wanted to kill people they didn't know. Havermeyer was a lead bombardier who never missed. Yossarian was a lead bombardier who had been demoted because he no longer gave a damn whether he missed or not. He had decided to live forever or die in the attempt, and his only mission each time he went up was to come down alive. The men had loved flying behind Yossarian, who used to come barreling in over the target from all directions and every height, climbing and diving and twisting and turning so steeply and sharply that it was all the pilots of the other 5 planes could do to stay in formation with him, leveling out only for the 2 or 3 seconds it took for the bombs to drop and then zooming off again with an aching howl of engines and wrenching his flight through the air so violently as he wove his way through the filthy barrages of flak that the 6 planes were soon flung out all over the sky like prayers, each one a pushover for the German fighters, which was just fine with Yossarian, for there were no German fighters anymore, and he did not want any exploding planes near his when they exploded. Only when all the Sturm und Drang had been left far behind would he tip his flak helmet back wearily on his sweating head and stop barking directions to McWatt at the controls, who had nothing better to wonder about at a time like that than where the bombs had fallen. "Bombay clear," Sergeant Knight in the back would announce. "Did we hit the bridge?" McWatt would ask. "I couldn't see, sir. I kept getting bounced around back here pretty hard, and I couldn't see. Everything's covered with smoke now, and I can't see. Hey, Arfi, did the bomb set the target?" "What target?" Captain Aardvark, Yossarian's plump, pipe-smoking navigator, would say from the confusion of maps he had created at Yossarian's side in the nose of the ship. "I don't think we're at the target yet, are we? Yossarian, did the bomb set the target?" "What bombs?" answered Yossarian, whose only concern had been the flak. "Oh, well," McWatt would sing, "what the hell?" Yossarian did not give a damn whether he hit the target or not, just as long as Havermeyer or one of the other lead bombardiers did, and they never had to go back. Every now and then, somebody grew angry enough at Havermeyer to throw a punch at him. "I said you men leave Captain Havermeyer alone," Colonel Cathcart warned them all angrily. "I said he's the best damn bombardier we've got, didn't I?" Havermeyer grinned at the colonel's intervention and shoved another piece of peanut brittle inside his face. Havermeyer had grown very proficient at shooting field mice at night with the gun he had stolen from the dead man in Yossarian's tent. His bait was a bar of candy, and he would pre-sight in the darkness as he sat waiting for the nibble with the finger of his other hand inside a loop of the line he had run from the frame of his mosquito net to the chain of the unfostered light bulb overhead. The line was taut as a banjo string, and the merest tug would snap it on and blind the shivering quarry in a blaze of light. Havermeyer would chortle exultantly as he watched the tiny mammal freeze and roll its terrified eyes about in frantic search of the intruder. Havermeyer would wait until the eyes fell upon his own, and then he laughed aloud and pulled the trigger at the same time, showering the rank, furry body all over the tent with a reverberating crash and dispatching its timid soul back to his or her creator. Late one night, Havermeyer fired a shot at a mouse that brought Hungry Joe bolting out at him barefoot, ranting at the top of his screechy voice and emptying his own .45 into Havermeyer's tent as he came charging down one side of the ditch and up the other and vanished all at once inside one of the slit trenches that had appeared like magic beside every tent the morning after Milo Minderbinder had bombed the squadron. It was just before dawn, during the great big siege of Bologna, when tonless dead men peopled the night hours like living ghosts, and Hungry Joe was half out of his mind because he had finished his missions again and was not scheduled to fly. Hungry Joe was babbling incoherently when they fished him out from the dank bottom of the slit trench, babbling of snakes, rats, and spiders. The others flashed their searchlights down just to make sure. There was nothing inside but a few inches of stagnant rainwater. "You see," cried Havermeyer, I told you he was crazy, didn't I?" And that is chapter 3. We learned a little more that time.
Yeah, a little bit. Yossarian's been demoted because of reasons.
Well, I kind of like that because obviously they send a few bombers out and a bunch of planes to support them. And he's like, "Look, I just don't want to get shot at, so I'm going to act like a lunatic. And I'm with Havermeyer, and he's just straight-laced, even though it's threatening the lives of his own men. But he does hit the target, so it doesn't matter what I do."
Is that what happened? I don't know. That's not what I...
Yeah. If you read, like, Yossarian didn't care whether he hit the target or not because Havermeyer was alongside him.
No, that's not what I read. I read Havermeyer was a lead bombardier who never missed. Yossarian was a lead bombardier, who had been demoted because he no longer gave a damn whether he missed or not.
Yeah. And then later,
it said the men had loved flying behind Yossarian. He used to come barreling in over the target from all directions at every height. So they used to follow him. They don't anymore. Now everyone is forced to fly after Havermeyer.
But if you look later on, there was that line here. I'll find it myself.
Okay. He didn't say, it's not what he said. He said,
here we go. Yossarian did not give a damn whether he hit the target or not, just as long as Havermeyer or one of the other lead bombardiers did, and they never had to go back.
Yeah, but that's not referring to, that was when Yossarian, right now, anyway, he doesn't care, because he doesn't want to go back. But the point is that he was a lead bombardier, and they had loved flying behind Yossarian. And this situation used to happen, and he was basically relying on Havermeyer or one of the others to hit it, because they always did. That was the idea. But the problem is that he got demoted and now Havemeyer's in front. And that's why Havemeyer occasionally gets punched.
Right.
Yeah, it's a bit twisty. It's a bit timey-wimey twisty-twisty. Mm. At least as far as I can read.
Yeah, so we've learned what Yossarian at least used to do. It's funny also that, like, we're talking about Havemeyer and Yossarian bombing, but, like, the whole start of that chapter was the very funny conversation with Orr winding up Yossarian over the crab apples in his cheeks and the incident at the brothel.
Which he didn't go into too much detail on, but yeah. He didn't. Like, there's, I think it's almost like we're getting little bits of information very slowly.
And everyone's a bit wound up tight and a bit odd.
Yes. Everyone is very unwell. And part of it is because they keep getting the wrong... they keep getting told, oh, you're going back after 50 missions, and then they keep changing the number, and he's like...
Yeah, because... And maybe that's part of Yossarian's madness, is he's trying to get 50 missions, but then the book tells us there are all these poor souls at the camp who've done their 50 and are just like wandering around like zombies, scared that the number is going to be increased, but they're not getting their letter that says they can go home.
Yeah, poor things.
And then it was, what was it? It was one of the general, I think Dreidel, who talked. Dr. Nika talking to Yossarian, talking about how listening to General Dreidel and others, how they wanted only 40 missions. So it must have been Peckham, because Peckham seems to be in charge of Cathcart, who seems to be the one who's in charge of Yossarian's troops.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is.
Who was he had the foolish speech about the USO. A lot happened in that chapter.
Yes, there was a lot. It's fascinating, fascinating. But I'm also disturbed by Havemeyer, and I really don't want him to, like...
Well, you know, like, I would think that an officer that wantonly puts his own men at risk is not... That's not a good officer or a man anyone wants to follow.
Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, that's... probably also part of why Hungry Joe shot up his tent. So, you know.
Yeah, Hungry Joe was the guy who lived near the officers, didn't he?
Yeah, he's not entirely well. And he's also, I think, right next to the rail line. And by the way, right at the beginning of that chapter, you know how there's their stove apparently has a leak? And it's being fixed?
Yeah.
Aren't they sitting... isn't their tent specifically right next to the fuel line?
Yeah, I think so. That's why Orr is getting the stove working in their tent when no other tent has one. There's also a weird... I mean, it's never really explained. Maybe it is later that there's a dead man in Yossarian's tent.
Whether he is actually a dead man that's in the tent or whether he's not.
Well, that's where Havemeyer got his pistol. That line about whether the... man was there, I think that was relating to he's no longer there because he's no longer alive. I think that was the joke.
But the thing is, you wouldn't leave a dead man in a tent like that.
A normal person wouldn't know.
No, but it doesn't sound like you know what I mean? Like it's almost like, is he actually there or is it just a figment of his...
And here's another thing, you know, that idea of the reliable narrator. Yossarian kind of is our narrator, not really. It's more an omnipotent look at everyone, but it seems Yossarian's our main character. So how much can we trust everything we're learning about what's going on here?
Yeah, which is why I just kind of look at it going,
It's all kind of madness at the moment, isn't it?
A little bit.
But, there was a lot of humor in that one. I laughed aloud quite a lot.
Yeah, it's been interesting. It's like some of it was...
You're Americans and no other soldiers on Earth can say that.
Yeah. It's the same kind of absurdity that I just kind of shake my head at with... when I watch MASH, I'm like, oh, God. Yeah, it's like same quippage.
Also the idea of the men just trying to survive and the higher-ups being a little removed from it all. Although technically Yossarian's a higher up as well. But, you know, there's always a higher up.
There's always a higher up to the higher up. Always. But yes.
I wonder if maybe he's no longer a captain, since, or if he was just demoted from Lee Bombardier and he's still a captain.
Well, he still flies, so he's a captain. So it's just, yeah, he'd be probably just a bit down the scale. Yes. Oh.
Anything else from the chapter that...
Not really. Like, there's just, it's, we're slowly getting to know little bits of information as they kind of arise, which is... interesting.
Yeah, I was reading someone talk about Catch-22 the other day, and it reminded me of something in the book that I'd forgotten about. I won't spoil it here. We'll uncover that as it happens. But yeah, what you just said, it actually does feel like the whole of Catch-22 is like a page out of a coloring book. And each chapter just colors in a little part of it, but it's all coloring in parts of different spaces. Mm. So it's going to take till the end till we kind of get the whole picture of everything.
Oh, yeah, it's going
to,
yeah.
Or at least, you know, a good chunk through when the shapes start to form and you get to see kind of what the whole picture is.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely feeling very, like...
Which is yet another reason I think, yeah, why so many people bounce off it now that I'm reminded of that aspect of the book.
Yeah, it's going to take time for it to, build up to explaining what's going on. It feels, yeah, a little bit like you're picking up bits and pieces, and then it the overarching story, I guess, is meant to be Yessarian trying to get home.
Mm. That's his motivation, at least at the moment.
That's, well, it feels like that's the story, like the story is about, and then everything that's happening around it is relevant, but there are actually a million other stories happening at the same time. So yeah. It's the chaos. And it's definitely, yeah, as you said, it's that he feels like the primary narrator or the person around whom everything is circling. So, yes.
Like, you know, that story about Orr at the brothel, maybe we learn more about that in the future, or maybe that was just that little funny one-off that we speculate about for the rest of time.
Mental.
Mm.
Yes. It's pretty hard to describe it as anything else. Oh, some fairly unhinged behavior.
Well, I guess we'll leave it there. That was a longer chapter this time. We kind of got all our discussion out beforehand. Hopefully, as we color in more of the color pencil page, because I'm keeping this metaphor going, damn it, we'll have more to discuss. It seems like the first two chapters you were finding your footing, Rue, and now you kind of understand what the book is, so now you're waiting for a greater picture to emerge.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, it's slowly building up, little bits, so it's trickling together.
So, the music at the top of the podcast is Soap Runs, composed by Rupert Gregson-Williams and Henry Gregson-Williams. It is off the 2019 Catch-22 adaptation. The music at the end of the podcast, as always, is I'm the Slime by Frank Zappa. You can find me over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip.
You can find me at Rue McMoo, that's Roomcmoo. And you can find our podcast at SMBSLT Podcast, both on Twitter, on Facebook, and if you add an @gmail.com, you get to our email.
Excellent. Yeah, please let us know what you were thinking of Catch-22 so far, if you've read the book yourself, how you enjoy our discussion, and if you have any suggestions for future books. As always, we would love to hear from you.
Yes. And until next time, we hope that you have a good week.
Until next time, yeah, please enjoy your reading, and we'll see you all later.
Happy reading, everyone, as I wave towards Dave.